I don't see any announcements up here, but I'll start by saying if you have a cell phone, turn it off, put it on, vibrate, silent, whatever you need to do so it doesn't interrupt the speakers. There's a special needs section over here exclusively for those who are in some way handicapped, and I heard at the last meeting I was at, alcoholism does not qualify you to sit there. Otherwise, you just put a big old sign right behind my head. I'm an alcoholic, and my name is Cynthia. Wow. My sobriety date is May 15th, 1985. I knew a girl, she got sober in Oklahoma in 85, and she said, we came alive in 85. I said, okay. I didn't come alive till about 90 or 91. It was 1990 when my home group in Okmulgee, Oklahoma said, circle and land, honey. We're not too sure where you are, but the rest of us are over here. I was having a hard time being self-supporting through my own contributions. I thought you guys were jealous of my nice parents. I did. We're going to open with a moment of silence and gratitude for the AA recoveries of the past 70 years. I want to thank Sarah P. from Vero Beach, Florida. Oh, that's where I'm from. I'm sorry. I'm from Vero Beach, Florida. And I am a member of the Vero 12 and 12 group. And I'd like to thank Sarah P. from Vero Beach for submitting my name to GSO. And actually, after she did that, she called me back and she said, you know, they're done with that. They've already got all their speakers and all the volunteers. Maybe you can do some other kind of service work. And I said, oh, okay, that's fine. And I forgot all about it. And the week of turning 20 years sober, I was home and my phone rang and it was Doug Richardson from GSO, and those are weird phone calls to get. And he's like, I wrote you a letter a month ago, and I haven't heard back from you, but I marked here that you'd chair a meeting. And I said, oh, I'd love to chair a meeting. And he said, I'm also trying to get a hold of this Natalie, and I can't find her. And I said, oh, I sponsor her, and she moved. And he said, I have her speaking at a meeting. And I said, oh, she'd love to speak. I mean, speak for her. She'd love to speak at a meeting. And he said, I said, okay, and I gave her the new number because she had moved, and he said, and her topic is, I thought he said, oh, my home group. And I started laughing, and I said, that is perfect. Natalie does not like her home group. And that is a great thing for her to go talk on. And she just did at 9 o'clock, and if you weren't there, it really was lovely. All of them did such a great job. And so they told me when I was doing this meeting, they said, well, your topic is going to be gratitude, a full and thankful heart. And I told that to someone, and they said, doesn't it sound like an ex-Hallmark employee named all these meetings? I said, yeah, the poor guy's just trying to make amends to Hallmark, you know. So I just think that's so funny. Gratitude is a very easy thing to talk about, but I come from, I don't know if you call it hardcore AA, but when I was sober in Oklahoma, they're big in the area of Okmulgee and Tulsa, that greeters greet and readers read and introducers introduce, and with that, I give you Sandy from Washington, D.C.
Good morning. My name is Sandy, and I'm an alcoholic. Area 13, Washington, D.C. A full and thankful heart. First, I thought of the word full. We alcoholics came to AA full of a lot of things, didn't we? Full of anger. Full of resentment. Full of discontent. Full of despair. full of baloney. And the flip side was that we were never full of much that was very worthwhile. We couldn't understand those social drinkers around us who declined a refill with a silly comment like, "No thanks, I'm full already. And I've had enough." When it came to drinking, we never stopped because we were full. We only stopped when it was impossible to continue, for whatever reason. Bill first wrote these words that are our topic today in an article in the AA Grapevine in March 1962, and it was reprinted in As Bill Sees It. The full sentence in which this phrase occurs reads, "I try hard to hold fast to the truth that a full and thankful heart cannot entertain great conceits." And conceits is another word for arrogance, isn't it? And as my alcoholism progressed, so did my arrogance and my ignorance as well. When we get into our cars, there's a little simple gauge on the dashboard right in front of our eyes when we drive. It has a lot of marks between two letters, E for empty and F for full. Most newer cars have a little warning light that blinks on and off when the fuel supply edges towards that empty. My car has a little icon shaped like a gas tank, and it blinks for a while, and it stays on steady, and that little marker starts moving towards the E. How do you react when that blinker light goes on? I don't see it too often anymore because I generally refill the tank before it slips too far below a quarter. But I know that it definitely adds some stress for me. I calculate, how far am I from a gas station? Or maybe can I make it home without stopping for gas and fill it up tomorrow? But I don't ignore it anymore. But I have a vivid memory of an episode in my drinking days around the empty gas tank. I had run out of booze, and I had to drive to get some more, you understand. I was in a rural community about 10 miles to the nearest liquor store. I had no credit cards in those days. I was an at-home housewife with young children. My husband was monitoring my drinking all the time. I would raid the house supply and water it down. But every now and then, I knew I had to refill it fast, or I might face another scene when he got home that evening. I was given a cash food allowance in those days, and that was it. So I had to squeeze that to include the booze, too. On this particular day, I packed my small preschool daughter and a large family dog into the car, and I headed for town. I knew the tank was close to empty, but I didn't have enough cash with me to add gas and still have enough to buy a bottle. First things first, right? Partway down a very lonely country road, yes, indeed, I ran out of gas. The car sputtered to a stop. There I was. I put the dog on a leash, carried the baby, and we walked down a lane to an absolute stranger's farmhouse set way back from the road. I knocked. I asked this complete stranger if I could use his phone because I'd run out of gas. I walked in. I didn't have any AAA card or any road service cards. I called information to get the phone number of the gas station near my house because it was also a company that delivered heating oil to my home, and they knew me. And I asked them, would they please bring me some gas? And when they arrived, I said that I was out of money right now, but I was going to the bank, and I would pay them on the way home. Because we were regular customers for more expensive stuff like heating oil, he just shook his head and he said, "No problem, just follow me back to the station now." And I said I had an appointment in town right now, but I'd stop by later. And I took his gallon of gas and, no surprise, continued in the direction of the liquor store. I didn't go to the bank. This was long before ATMs even existed. I didn't have a checkbook with me, just enough cash to buy that bottle. So I didn't stop at the gas station on the way home at all. But later that evening, I told my husband, whom I now call my husband, I told him what happened, and I asked him to stop at the gas station the next morning and pay them. And he gave me one of those looks, remember? He probably just thought how careless I was not to notice the gas gauge going empty, and I had no idea why I'd really gone out. My daughter was too young to tell on me then. But that incident stuck in my mind for many years, how I'd taken such a risk with a small child. I knew the gauge was empty, but I ignored it because getting a new supply of booze was more important. The tank was empty, but I was full of guilt and shame. I kept it to myself, tried to forget all about it. You remember that. I like to think I'd like to have a spiritual gauge as visible as the one on my car, don't you? A warning light that goes on when my own thanks tanks are getting towards empty. It's not always on full, you know. Have you thought about how your thanks tanks are today? The word gratitude used to mean gratification to me, something I knew a lot about. Somehow I never could get full of gratification either. The word gratitude, sure, I heard a lot about it growing up. My parents married during the Great Depression of the 1930s. And folks my age remember things similar to my memories. Our parents wanted their children to avoid the anxious realities of financial deprivation that they'd experienced. They also wanted us to appreciate what they were doing for us in better times, that we should be grateful. It had no meaning to me as a child. I sat at the dinner table objecting to something on my plate like Brussels sprouts or turnips, and I would hear, "Be grateful that you have something to eat. Children are starving in Armenia." I had no idea where Armenia was. Perhaps your parents used a different country. But the idea was that we should be grateful for what we had. It was an abstraction that went right over my head. I don't like the taste of this. I don't want to eat it. One time I rudely replied, "Okay then, wrap this up and send it to the children in Armenia." But I paid for that one. I was supposed to send a thank you note to Aunt Minnie for sending me a birthday gift that I didn't like. Gratitude was a chore, like cleaning my room or taking out the garbage. In the midst of the worst period of my drinking, I would sit down in my family room long after everyone else in the house went to bed. I would be sipping, listening to sad music, probably crying, and reflecting on my poor, pitiful situation. Now, I had a husband who provided everything financial. I had two healthy young children. I had a lovely home filled with everything one needed to live comfortably, and I was miserable. The TV then was reporting disasters around the world in the late 1960s. There was famine and children were starving again. This time it was Biafra, as I recall, and they showed pictures of them on the TV at night, and I would weep into my cups about it, but it didn't fill me with gratitude. Their pain was remote, however real. My pain was present and persistent, and it had no reasonable explanation. Maybe, indeed, I was truly crazy. Did you ever have the experience sometimes of doing the right things for the wrong reasons, pretending to be grateful when the motivation wasn't there? Here's one of mine. I had read in my college alumni magazine that the dean was retiring. She'd been helpful to me, but we'd really not had any special relationship at all, and it had been over 10 years since I'd graduated. She wouldn't even remember me. But the article suggested that alumni might want to send in notes of appreciation to this woman on her retirement. So I sat down, filled to the brim with whatever I was drinking that day, wrote some sloppy, sentimental note, and sent it off to her. Weeks later, I got a letter back telling me how much my note had meant to her, that indeed she remembered me well, and she wished the best for me in the fine future she knew I was having. And I couldn't even remember what I'd written or why. Benevolent acts done under the influence did not add to my self-esteem. and I was not having a fine future. And I felt guilty for doing a nice thing. I went, reluctantly, of course, to my first AA meeting on the 3rd of November, 1969. There are only two ways that any of us arrived here. There are those few who, having seen the light, walk into their first meeting and are sober from that moment forward. And then there's the second group who have not seen the light but have only felt the heat. I was in that group. So not surprisingly, I didn't stop drinking on that first meeting date. But I did begin to hear you and observe you. Having come in November, one of the groups I went to met on Thursdays. And the week prior to Thanksgiving, I remember saying to them, well, I suppose you won't have a meeting next week on the holiday. And they said, most especially, do we meet on the holiday? I vaguely recall some painful, familiar routine that Thanksgiving of overdoing everything for holiday preparations, getting drunk, sneaking booze from my hidden supplies. At that point, I used to keep rot-gut vodka in a white vinegar bottle in my kitchen cupboard. Oh, I thought it was clever. Nobody was going to find it. But the Thanksgiving day that year had no thanks in it whatsoever. The next year came, 1970. I kept attending AA meetings. My desire to stop drinking, the only requirement for membership, did increase. I went to a treatment program. I stopped drinking for weeks and months at a time, although not continuously. I was dry the next year in November, and there were a few more episodes until my last drink in March of 1971. But even with this spotty start, I was listening and hearing things at meetings. During November of 1970, I was at a woman's meeting when I heard Jane A. I was still prone to the fruitless but familiar attitude of comparing rather than identifying. And compared with Jane, I should feel grateful. Jane was a small, troubled woman. She had many difficulties. Her husband had lost his job. One of their children had a chronic disability. The family was facing a lot of problems. And the topic of the meeting that day, being November, of course, no secret, was gratitude. I sat back secretly sighing. Not another gratitude meeting. And despite this brick wall of resistance, Jane's sharing that day snapped right through to me. She said that because of the program of recovery and the fellowship of caring people around her, she was able to feel grateful even though she wasn't happy. She looked sad. She wasn't smiling. And the other women nodded as she spoke, in that wonderful way of silent support that we give one another. And I was shaking in my silence. Wow! Was it possible to be grateful when I wasn't happy? I had always kept the two together. I couldn't remember thinking about being grateful unless I was happy. And happy meant getting what I wanted when I wanted it. Towards the end of my drinking days, I became grateful only when I avoided disaster. Whew, got out of that one. Remember that? But Jane's insights that day to me in November of 1970 slipped way down inside me, and they're with me still. I've not seen or heard from Jane in many years, but I'm truly grateful for what she shared with me that day, one of those aha moments that began to change my life. I came to AA at the age of 33, already an old, decrepit, defeated person in terms of how I viewed myself and the world. And I'm sober since the age of 35. My next body's birthday, God willing, in next January, I will turn 70 years old. And a few weeks later, God willing, I will have my 35th anniversary of continuous sobriety. So I guess I have to redefine what I mean by an old lady, right? The rotten wrinkles of despair and misery that marked my insides as a sick and sad young woman have all been smoothed out in sobriety and replaced just with some ordinary ones on the outside. The only time I know I'm aging on the outside is when I pass a mirror and I briefly ask, who is that old woman? And I laugh. And while I have no problems accepting other women's desires to perhaps have cosmetic surgery or a facelift to defy the elements of aging, I think I'll just keep on keeping on with the one I have. I read recently that if you laugh a lot as you age, your wrinkles will all be in the right places. I'm grateful that I laugh a lot, and I'm grateful that wrinkles don't hurt at all. The word happy isn't up front much anymore. I still associate it with instant gratification, and sure, I feel it momentarily when something superficially satisfying happens, when I find a surprise bargain at the store or something. My general mood I would describe as content, with amazingly frequent moments of just sheer joy. I think we had a couple of those last night. I can't predict joy. I can't script it. It's a byproduct of living a life based on the principles of AA. This is my 6th international convention. I've been to New Orleans, Montreal, Seattle, San Diego, Minneapolis, and now Toronto. I feel full. I felt full and thankful at the first one. And now it's increased every time. How can that be? When I finally got 1 year of sobriety, after 2.5 years around the program, I said something totally unoriginal at my anniversary celebration, like, my cup runneth over. One of my sponsors came up to me and hugged me and said, Sandy, you better pray for a bigger cup. And so it has happened. Each year I'm given a new cup, partly filled, and I have another year, a day at a time, to fill it up in the fellowship. Looking back, that first year's cup was probably a tiny thimble, but that's all I could hold at the time. And so it was full. And with each new year, this new way of life has given me a bigger cup. I have long loved a book by Khalil Gibran called The Prophet. I read it drunk. I read it sober. And in it, this thought has always reminded me of my life before and after sobriety. He wrote, quote, your joy is your sorrow unmasked. And the self-same well from which your laughter rises was oft-times filled with your tears. And how else can it be? The deeper that sorrow carves into your being, the more joy you can contain. We have all surely known sorrow, and we've been filled with tears. And if that pain has carved us out to contain more joy, then we all now have a very large capacity for a full and thankful heart. Thank you.
Thank you. This is my 3rd international conference. I was about 11 minutes sober in 1985, a couple months, but. And then in 1990, we'll just blame that on some crazy cowboy in Oklahoma. And then I have been to San Diego, Minneapolis, and here, and well, I think Toronto set the bar pretty high, so they better start working now on, I think it's San Antonio. But in San Diego, it would have never dawned on me to speak at a meeting, chair a meeting. My first sponsor spoke at a meeting in San Diego, and I know I went to that meeting, and I just thought you had to be like oodles a year sober. And, you know, like, she was very well known in our area. They called her Amazing Grace. And She was tough. And then in Minnesota, I would have loved, I thought they should have called me and asked. And I would have loved to have chaired a meeting. And it seemed to me, and this is how I remember, that every meeting I went to in Minneapolis, I would hear the speakers say, oh, this isn't about me. And I think if I was up there, it'd be about me a little bit. You know, and like this much. And, you know, so My husband was with me in Minneapolis, and he is a make the coffee, take the meeting to detox kind of guy. He did not have fun. He does not like a crowd, and he kind of got flipped out of the block party in Minneapolis, and it was really miserable, and said, if you want to go to Toronto, I will pay for you and whoever you want to take. Just I brought Natalie and Lisa. And so when they called me to do this, and I was so excited, I thought, oh, damn, it really isn't about me. I just get to be the chairman. And so with that, I get to introduce Robert from London.
Good morning. My name is Robert Nelson. I'm an alcoholic. Set down. Anyway, the good news is, Cynthia says that if I go over my time, she'll put her hand up my kilt. So I'll be speaking for about an hour. A guy phoned me up a few years ago, and from America, from Texas, and he said, a friend from California said, Michael's going to phone you up. He says, he's actually a Scottish guy. He says, he's going to phone you up and ask if you go over and speak at a convention. So I got a phone call one night, and I said, hello, Robert Nelson here. He says, Robert, this is Michael. Oh, Michael. He says, you know, he's popular. I says, Michael, how long have you been in America, Michael? I've been here 7 years. I says, why are you speaking like that? He says, they don't understand you if you speak with a Scottish accent. Well, I'm afraid you'll get the Scottish accent this morning. You'll have to decipher it. Anyway, it's I realize it's a truly great honor to be here this morning. There's a lot of people here that I know. There's actually four guys sitting just here who I grew up with. They've all lived within 100 yards of one another. And we were sitting the other night talking, you know, and I just said, who would have thought this? You know, we came from a poor working class town, Coatbridge, which is just outside Glasgow. And here we are, all with kind of good lengths of sobriety, sitting in Toronto, enjoying ourselves sober. And I just want to thank you so much. Thanks for coming. All the people who came here to support me this morning, thank you from the bottom of my heart. Thank you. Anyway, this the last we said about fool, you know, the Scottish people know this. This is a term that they use when you're really full of drink. You know, people say, oh, he's fool. You know, so we know all about fool. The guys we coped drink were never full. Right? There was never enough drink for us. I started drinking when I was... I first bought alcohol when I was 14. I mean, we grew up in a society where if you're a cold, you might get a hot toddy. And you always had the cold. You know, you're going to get a hot toddy. You get a little bit of whiskey and put sugar in it and things like that. But I first bought it when I was 14. Me and one of my pals, we bought cheap wine. You know that stuff, it's like paint stripper. You know, you're holding your nose, pouring it over, VP wine. And you know, when I look back, I think one of the exciting things about drinking now is that we were doing something we shouldn't have been doing. You know, we were 14. It's a bit like smoking. You know, when you first start smoking at school, you know, and it's exciting. And I loved it. I didn't like the taste, but I love the effect, you know, and I'd grown up in a society where people would do things that were wrong, and then they'd say, oh, I was drunk, you know, and it seemed a good get-out, you know, oh, I was drunk. And I love this idea of being able to do something and say, oh, I was drunk. And the next big thing that happened to me was when I had a few drinks, you know, maybe half bottles of wine, bottles of wine. And I left school. My parents died when I was young, and I left school at 15, became an apprentice carpenter, and started drinking weekly. Friday nights, we go out, what a young guy, the guys before Bridge know us. Go out, cheap wine, cider, get drunk, maybe get a wee bit of a boiler, fight or something like that, and go to the dancing. The next big thing that happened to me was getting served in the pub, getting served in the bar, which was a big thing, you know, and I remember going to the next town, Airdrie, went to Airdrie at the dancing with one of my friends, and we decided, do you think we should try and get served in a pub tonight, you know, so we think we drank a half bottle of wine. So we went into this pub, went into the back room, and the barman came in, and we were sitting kind of with our heads down, and the barman came over and said, yes, boys. I was like, 2 pints. And he went away and got the pint. And it was like, yes, we've arrived. We're pub drinkers now, you know. And going to work on the Monday morning, and I said, yeah, I was in the Waverley Bar the other night. It was as if I drank in pubs all the time. But very soon I was drinking in pubs all the time, and I was always quite tall. I never ever got asked about my age. I got any bits of trouble. But, yeah, we're all running about. We're all teenagers. I joined the army when I was 18. I joined the Scottish Regiment. Serious drinking. And I got into serious drinking then. And everything that went along with it. I got into a lot of trouble in the army. I spent as much time running away from the army as being in the army. I ended up getting court-martialed. I got sent to an army prison for quite a long time, come out, carried on drinking, carried on being a soldier. And then I get married. And I had one of these alcoholic relationships where, depending on whether I've been drinking or not, I used to go out to this Betty, who became my wife, you know, we're going out, then we weren't going out, we were going out, we weren't going out. And then we just said, we'll get engaged. That'll stop all this nonsense. And we got engaged, and then we were fighting again, and the ring was getting thrown, and oh, God. And then we'll get married, very quickly, we'll get married. And where I come from, when you get married very quickly, it means one thing, you know. And everybody was going, oh, yeah. No, she's not pregnant. I haven't even touched her. But, unfortunately. But we did get married. Without any thought about what we were going to do. My wife was just turned 19, probably going on 17, and I was 21, going on 12. You know, and it was crazy when I look back on it. She was a great woman. She was a great woman. Anyway, it says in her big book, lack of power was her dilemma. At this point, lack of money was my dilemma. I never really had enough money to drink the way I wanted to drink. And then the army sent me to Germany. And them that's been in the British forces, you go to Germany, you get duty-free booze. You know, you would get a bottle of booze for a dollar, you know, 50 pence in British money. And it was like paradise. I thought I'd landed in paradise. You know, it was like, yes. And all the other soldiers, all these Scottish soldiers, we thought it was great with parties and everybody was getting drunk, you know, and then there was the consequences, you know, and then the consequences were I'd get home late from work, you know, I'd maybe go for a drink and I'd come home, my wife had my dinner in the oven, you know, and the steak was all curled up, you know, and potatoes were like rocks, you know, and sometimes, out of spite, I would sit and eat it, you know, and my wife would be sitting looking at me saying, God, is he crazy? And we'd fall out, we'd have arguments, and we'd You know, walking in the house, walking past one another in the house, not talking, you know. Do you want your dinner? Yes. And I used to play this kind of modelling. Alcoholics love modelling music, so when you're drinking, you know, it's country and western stuff and all that, you know. And I had this Andy Williams LP, which I played continually when I was drinking. And it had helped me make it through the night was on it, and I, rainy days and Mondays always get you down. You've got a friend, you know. And I'd be playing this stuff, and I'd hear my wife coming out the bedroom. So I sat crying. My wife had come in, and I'm so sorry. And I was, and trust me, I was sorry. And my dear wee wife, she'd say, okay, we'll start again. And do you know something? I had a thousand start agains. And we'd go to bed, and it was great. And I'd be okay for a few weeks, and then I'd do it again. And that's the way it continued for a while. And then we come back to Britain. Now, when you've been drinking duty-free booze and paying nothing for it, it's a bit of a culture shock when you've got to pay the right price. And so consequently, my drinking subsided for a little while. Then the army sent us back to Germany again for 3 years. And all I could think about, I mean, a lot of people go, you know, soldiers, when they go to Germany, they think, oh, I might learn German, do a bit of touring, go to Italy or something like that. All I could think about was duty-free. Yoo-hoo, here we go again. And it's the first time I had been there, I had been bad. The next 3 years became an absolute bloody nightmare. You know, and the alcoholics in here know that. You know that. You know, and I changed the drinks. I went through. I love chapter 3. When I first had chapter 3 getting read, I thought, God, that's what I think. Where it says, here are some of the things we tried. Just drank beer. You know, stayed in. Didn't go to party. I tried all that. And it would work for a little while, and then it wasn't working, you know. And I've heard people saying, oh, I never had a hangover when I drank. Well, good for you, because I had plenty. I'm telling you, I spent a lot of time in the toilet. And I was said to my wife one day, I said, I'm the boss in this house. And she says, you're the boss in this shit house. Because I spent a lot of time in there, you know, and I'd get up in the morning, and I spent a lot of time in my head in the toilet pan. You know, it's nice and cool in there, you know, you put your head on that enamel, you know. Oh, God. Alcoholics are the only people that look at toilet water from 2 inches, you know. And you know your toothbrush? That's a great thing, that, for brushing that stuff off your tongue. Yeah. I used to wake up, I mean, when I went to bed at night, my tongue was okay. You know, I think somebody put fertilizer in there. I'd wake up, God. Are we stupid? I mean, we're paying good money for this. You know, you wake up in the morning, I'd be trying Andrew's liver salts, I'd be, you know, it says put one teaspoon, but I'd put big tablespoons in and stirring it all, trying to get rid of the dehydration. Bloodshot eyes, big puffy face. I used to pull the clothes on. My wife looked after me. You know, I had all my clean army clothes. I would jump out of my bed, probably slept in for work again, and I would pull on what I dropped on the floor. I'd pick the socks up and go, ah, they'll do fine. And I'd pull it out. I feel a lot of sweat. So I'd get aftershave and throw aftershave under my arms, you know. And I'd go to work, you know, and somebody say, heavy night last night, was it? I thought I looked great, you know. But it was becoming serious, you know, and there was a lot of arguments. I was beginning to wake up in the morning. I was full of remorse, shame, guilt. Couldn't understand it. Could not understand why I kept ending up like this. And I'd be off it for days and then I'd drink. I'd be off it for weeks and then I'd drink. A couple of occasions I was off it for several months and then I drank. And when I was off it, I was a good guy. You know, I was a good husband. I was a good father. We ended up with 3 little kids. And yet I kept waking up in the morning, feeling like death warmed up. And I remember my wife, I could hear my wife coming up, you know, a Sunday morning or something. I could hear the stairs creaking. And I curled into a little ball and I pulled the covers over and I started going, and my wife came into the room and she said, I know you're awake, you'll have to come out sometime. Oh God. And she was right, you know. When I speak to people about drinking, see, drinking's easy. Well, I find it easy anyway. I never ever get cramp, you know. I've never met an alcoholic in my life and went, I can't get my arm up, you know. No, I've had too much. You know, I could never understand people at the end of a night in a pub who had spare drinks left. You say, anybody want this drink? And the sharp's mouth, I'm like, oh, I'll take it. You know, I couldn't remember some of the things that happened the night before, and I was walking about with my head down. You can always tell alcoholics, you think they've lost money. You know, they're walking like that. frightened to look people in the eye. Charlie says, tell me about the sheep. But that was just a joke, Charlie, honestly. The whole thing just became a bloody nightmare. It became a nightmare. And I didn't know. I did not know that I was an alcoholic. There was guys that I drank with who I thought had serious problems. One of my pals used to pee in the wardrobe. He says, my wife's not happy. You know, another guy that I knew, he used to see a man sitting on the end of the bed. He says, this guy's got a black suit. He just keeps looking at me. He had a problem. Another guy used to hit his wife continually. He had a problem. I didn't have a problem. So I thought. But anyway, the whole thing started collapsing. And at the end, my marriage collapsed. My career collapsed in the army. I went to London and ended up living in the streets of London. Not for long, a few months. I know you can live in your own gutter in your own house. I know that from the people I've met in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't care anymore. I had a wife and three little kids. And I'll tell you this, the last Christmas I drank, I got arrested out of my house at 7 o'clock in the morning. The cops came and got me at 7 o'clock in the morning, took me away Christmas Day. I didn't see my kids, toys or anything. Took me away, and I got out 2 days later, and I went home, and I'll tell you, I felt bad. I felt terrible. And I was crying, I was pleading with my wife. I said, please give me another chance. And she says, why should I? You've done this continually. I said, please, I promise you, I'll never drink again. And it was coming up to New Year, and Scottish people love New Year. And she says, what about New Year? I said, I won't buy any drink. I won't buy any drink. I'll lock the door. And I did. And I get through New Year's Day. Now, see, on that day, that was the 27th of December. I'm not a gambler. If I had been £1 million, I would have bet you £1 million I was never going to drink again. I felt so bad. And I get through New Year's Day. And the 2nd of January, my brother came up to the house, and he says, here, have a whiskey. I says, no, I'm not drinking, Andy, it's finished. He says, come on, it's a new year, just have one drink. And I said, and I looked at my wife, and she's looking at me, and I said, and my brother looked at my wife, and he says, oh, come on, just one drink. So I took the drink. And you know what happens? Took another one. A couple hours later, I'm down at an off license, getting a big cargo of drink. You know, and anyway, I ended up in the streets. And one day, I was going to say, I don't know if you believe in miracles. Of course you believe in miracles. We are miracles. We are here. We are miracles. Anyway, I phoned Alcoholics Anonymous one day. I was committing a crime. I was in the process of committing a crime to get money for drink. And I thought, I need help. God, I need help. And I thought, I'll phone Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know anyone in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't even know what Alcoholics Anonymous was really about. I knew it was alcohol somewhere. And I phoned up. And thank God for our telephone service. Thank God there was somebody sitting in our office to answer the phone. And I went to a meeting. And I walked into this meeting. It was a lunchtime meeting. I walked in. There was little cards that said AA. And I walked in and I went, oh, sorry, I thought I'm in the wrong place. And I walked back out, because these people had suits on. There were some nice women with nice dresses, and I thought, oh, God, I walked into a church social or something, you know. But the little sign said, hey, so I thought, oh, and you know how self-centered. I thought, I'm going to have to walk through that room. So I went back. Such was my desperation. Under normal circumstances, I wouldn't have went back. But I walked in, and this man came over. He happened to be Scottish, but that's by the by. He came over and he said, who are you looking for, son? I said, I'm looking for AA. And he put his hand out, he says, my name's Peter, and I'm an alcoholic. Never underestimate the power of a handshake. that can be immense. That has never left me. Don't mind saying my name's Peter, and I'm an alcoholic, has never left me. I then said, I don't drink methylated spirits. And Peter said, it doesn't matter how much you drank, how often you drank, or what you drank. He said, what happens when you drink? And here I was 29, done all this stuff, and on no occasion had I ever thought, this happens to me as a direct result of me drinking. And I went home to Scotland, I got back to my wife, I was going to meetings in our town, I loved it, I loved all the war stories, they were all talking about fighting the cops, and being in prison, and being locked up in psychiatric hospitals, and it was like a competition to see who'd been in the most hospitals, you know. And I heard the man saying, he's in here today, I think, Ernie, and at a convention recently, he said, about the newcomer that says to the old-timer, do you have to pay in here? And the old-timer says, yeah, you've got to pay. You've got to pay attention. And I never paid attention. And consequently, other things became my priority, and I drank again. I drank for the whole of July. I came in 75, I drank for the whole of July 76. And nothing had changed. For any of us that's been back out there, we know that. Nothing changes. Thank God, on the 1st of August, I stopped drinking again, and I've been here ever since. And thank God for that. You know, it's. And I'm going to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 30 years of age. I was a big, fit laddie. You know, and I didn't come back here because I thought, oh, I might die. We're all going to die. Everybody's going to die. Alcoholics, on the whole, tend to live long lives. They don't all die young. You hear people saying, oh, you'll die. Yeah, if you're lucky, you know. Most of the people I know just live long, protracted, not very nice lives. And it was a thought, I thought this could go on for a long time. And I come back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and my life began to change. I asked a man to come and give me some help, and he started telling me things. This man taught me a lot of stuff about Alcoholics Anonymous. And he wasn't your kind of, you know, big book kind of guru who could quote pages and things like that. This man taught me a lot of common sense. He says, this isn't a competition we're in here, son. He says, we're not in here to see who can get the biggest car, who can get the biggest house, who can get the biggest bonus. He says, we're in here to stay sober. And we do it on a daily basis. He taught me that when a mixed bunch of alcoholics and us, I said to this guy, it'd be great if they're all like me and you. And he said, if they're all like you, he says, I wouldn't come. But then he said, if they were all like me, I wouldn't come either. You know, he says, we're a mixed bunch in here, son. He says, there's room for everybody. And the God thing, you know, he says, son, he says, some people believe in God. Some people hate the word God. Some people think they are God. He says, find yourself a wee spot in here. And I did that. And my life suddenly started to get better. And I was going to lots of meetings. I get involved in service. Service is great in alcohol. It teaches you tolerance. If nothing else, it teaches you the tolerance. You know, when you're making a tea and somebody comes up and says, have you got a decaf tea? It's not big in Scotland. And you might get some posh guy going, hey, Jimmy, you couldn't have a decaf tea, could I? What do you think you have, the rainbow coffee? You know? And then somebody would move my cups. I had all my cups lined up, you know. Somebody knocks on cups. I pick the cups up. You all right? Good to be sober. And I've had lots of great times in sobriety. You know, not everything's been great. MD's been sober a while, knows that. You know, we all have the problems of life that go on, you know. Deaths. I mean, I haven't had MD die. Oh, my sister-in-law died a couple of years ago. I know people that said family, you know, children dying, sobriety, and they've stayed sober. All sorts of stuff. My marriage broke up. I was about 12 years sober when my marriage broke up. And that was difficult for me. It was really difficult. I didn't want to get divorced. And people went Alcoholics Anonymous. See, when I was kind of going like that, people kind of stood beside me and made sure that I didn't fall. And that's what this is about. That's what sobriety is about for us and Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we all have times when you know, they maybe start heading in the wrong direction. People just knock you back into line. Don't drink, no matter what happens in your life, don't drink. And I got over that. Here at 10 later, I was over it again. I was swimming in clear water. I've been able to get about. I've met people from all over America. I've been to lots of places in America. Sobriety for me just changed my life. It changed my life completely. To the guy I used to be, I'm not the same. I don't blame him. I don't blame Andy for the way I grew up and what I thought. That's the way it was. People done their best. Nobody said, oh, we're going to make Robert Nelson's life crap. You know, they've done their best. They didn't go any better. You know, and I know better today. I've got three children who've all grown up with a sober dad. Now they can't remember me drinking. They just think, my dad's a bit zany at times, you know. And I believe they think I'm a good dad, you know. I gave my wee grandson, I've got two grandchildren, I gave my grandson. You haven't put your hand up my kilt yet?
No.
I gave my grandson, maybe grandson Robbie, my 25th, my dad, you know, my chip, you know, your sobriety chip. I gave Robbie, and my other daughter was telling, she took my grandson to the weekend, and she said, wee Robbie said, my granddad gets medals for not drinking beer. Anyway, we all get medals for not drinking beer, and all the other stuff as well. Anyway, my time is up. I've tried to tell you, I get told, talk about what you know. Talk about what you know. Give alcoholics a room, give an alcoholic a subject to talk on. They're like politicians. They start off on the subject and then end up talking what they want to talk about. Anyway. God bless you. See last night, see when the Pipers came out last night. See all those jocks? We were like that. Yes! You know. Anyway, God bless you. I don't want to name all my, I'd be here all day naming my friends. But thank you for coming. Have a great convention. Go to Scotland for your holidays. It's a great country. And God bless you and keep the faith.
We need to report to my sponsor. My hands are right here. Been on the table like this. What's under there, by the way? Oh, you know what? That's a whole nother meeting. Ooh. Oh, shit. Oh.
The only thing that's under here is my socks.
Oh. I don't. Wow. Our next speaker is Barry from right here in Toronto.
For having me here. It's really an honor and a privilege to take part, especially in something of this magnitude. I'm just overwhelmed. I can remember what driving in this morning. The only thing that I asked God was, please let me get down before I cry. You know, the feelings that I have when I'm up here become overwhelming. And in truth, last night, I got hooked on the first guy that walked out. The first Piper that came out I was in. He already had me. The rest was a plus. I mean, being here is a thrill. And the topic that, you know, I should mention that I'm a member of the Rocks Glen Traditional Group in Toronto here. Sorry about that. It's now world famous since Tom and I spoke there Thursday night. You know, the topic that I was asked to speak on is gratitude and a full and thankful heart. And quite frankly, before I ever got here, I didn't think gratitude was an endearing quality. It would not be something that I would aspire to. It smacked of weakness to me. And people used to tell me all the time, you should be grateful for the life you have and grateful for the things that you have in your life. And quite frankly, I didn't feel that inside. The only thing that I ever felt for anything that I ever had was I was entitled to what I had. And I was entitled to what I was going to get. And anything I'd lost, I was entitled to get back. Now, that was just being full of myself. And when it talks about a full and thankful heart, you know, I was so full of myself that I had no room for anything else. And that's just the way that it was for me. When I was driving in this morning, I was full of anxiety around 9, and 10 seconds ago it turned to absolute terror. This room has grown since I stood up. You know, I'm the baby up here. I might as well get that part out of the way. This is the actual first world conference I've ever been at. I've gone to lots of conferences. And next week I'll celebrate 15 years. So, I don't say that, you know, I need to say that for me. I need to remind myself, okay, that that's why I'm here, you know. And the topic gratitude, I actually looked it up in the dictionary last night. I thought that would be kind of novel for me to stand up and try to talk about what I was asked to talk about rather than myself. And it said gratitude, a thankfulness within an appreciation of kindness. And all you people, I want you to know that you showed me a lot of kindness when I got here. And you showed me a lot of care and concern. Some of the kindness, by the way, was stapled to the end of a baseball bat. But I needed that. You had to get my attention first. You know, my impression of Alcoholics Anonymous when I got here was a lot different than it is today. You know, before I ever came here, I did everything to avoid coming. I did not want to be one of you. Because my impression of Alcoholics Anonymous was, and I get appalled at my own thoughts, but I might as well be as honest as I can. My impression of Alcoholics Anonymous was that you're burned out, worn out, drunk out, and absolute losers. The bane of society. And I defy you to look around this room and find anybody that fits that description today. See, the winners are here. And what I was describing was me before I got here. That's how I lived. Okay, I was a loser in every area of my life. You know, boy, I just lost my thought. It's okay, it'll come back. You know, I said that I'm sober 15 years, but in truth, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous 27 years ago. I was one of these guys, if you're sitting out there and you're having a tough time, and if you're sitting there and you're coming back and you're saying this thing doesn't work, and I've tried it, and it just didn't work for me, I'm here to tell you it works. You know, if you can actually tell someone what's going on in your life, it will change. One of the biggest problems that I ever had was I could never tell the truth. I could never tell you how bad my life was because it always looked pretty good on the outside. You know, I didn't drink every day. But every day I drank, I got drunk. And when I did drink, I felt better. It changed how I felt inside. And if it does that for you, you're going to find a word that became very important to me, and that was more. Because whenever I started to feel like that, I needed more. And I would drink more. And I needed to feel better, and I would wake up the next day feeling worse. And I would only drink again to feel better, to wake up the next day to feel worse. And the downward spiral of my life began. And nothing good followed. And it was unbelievable how, in the course of that spiral downward, I could rationalize and justify the places that I ended up in, the people that I ended up with, and the things that I was doing. I'm appalled today to stand here and say that, you know, that's just the way my life was. And I have to tell you that, like I said, I didn't drink every day. I had long periods of time where I didn't drink. And I worked. I thought as long as I could be successful, I was okay. You know, to me, the only thing that was important in my life was health and prosperity. And when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I came here from a park bench, by the way, and when I came here, the only thing that I had on my mind 27 years ago was health and prosperity. I figured if I just didn't drink, I'd be okay. I just wanted to get on with all the things I had to do in my life. And, you know, I think it's quite humorous if I look back. My whole life was spent trying to quit drinking, only to drink. First time I ever seriously tried to quit drink, I was probably in my early 20s, and I had a job working as a sales representative for a major distillery. And I'll tell you, that certainly became a problem in my life. Anyways, I actually quit that, and I decided that, you know, if I wanted to amount to anything, I'd have to, you know, go back into business for myself, and I did, and I was able to quit drinking. I have no idea how. And I was not coming here because I already gave you my impression of what you were like. And I didn't want anything to do with you. So I had, you know, the drive to succeed was on, like it says in the big book, and there I was. And 4 years later, I haven't had a drink, and I'm stark raving mad. I mean, I have no program. I have nothing. I'm living in a great house, and I'm in a great relationship, and cars, and life's good, and I should be grateful. And I'm absolutely feeling like hell inside, and there's nobody I can tell. And I didn't think there'd be anybody that would understand how I felt. That sense of terror, that isolation, that loneliness that creeps up inside. And the idea that something's going to happen that's not going to be good, and I don't know when it's going to happen, but it's going to happen to me. You know, that's just how I felt every day. And I wasn't drinking. So that's just alcoholism without a drink. So I knew what alcohol would do for me, and I made a decision, a conscious decision, that I was going to get drunk one day. I was just going to get drunk for that day, and then I'd be okay the next day, but I needed to let the pressure off. I'd had 4 years, and boy, I was dying. And I did get drunk. And it was my plan, as I said, to get sober the next day and get on with my life. I woke up a year and a half later, and I was living on a park bench. Alcohol did not care what I had planned. Alcohol had its own plan. And you know, when I showed up at Alcoholics Anonymous, that bought me my entrance into AA. I showed up here with an arrogance that I still find appalling to me. And I showed up with the wrong attitude, because I showed up with the answers. I just moved in from the park bench, and I had a lot of answers. You know, I don't know what I was thinking. But, you know, the only thing that I did was keep coming here. You know, I stayed for 3 years, 4 years, 4 years. I got lots of medallions. Jesus. I had a friend of mine, he's passed on now. He used to say, Barry, I think you're going to, you know, you might, if you stick around long enough, you might collect enough to make a belt. And he said, but I think you'll die before that. You might make a hat band. And I thought that was a very unkind thing to say. You know, I got here, and I got here, and I was absolutely hopeless. And I had nowhere else to go. Because if I had had an option, I would have worked the option before I came here. That's been the story of my life. Before I ever make a decision, I know what the decision's got to be. Even today, I know what I have to do. But I'll try to find a few options that might make it easier. Because I'm really not interested sometimes in facing the hard choices in life. So I came here, and ironically enough, when you associate yourself with this fellowship, good things happen. I don't care what you're doing. If you're here, things are going to happen. And things happened in my life in spite of the fact that I had no sponsor. I refused to work these steps. I just refused. And pray? I don't know. I'd recite the Lord's Prayer at the end with you so you didn't think I was stupid. That was it. I had no concept of God and no intention. And as a result, I got drunk. Nothing in, nothing out. That's just the way it is. So I had to be beaten into a state of submission. That was 15 years ago and the book talks about a pitiful and incomprehensible state of demoralization. And that's where I was. And I came out of a drunk yet again. And I was stone cold sober, and it was unbelievable to me because 5 hours before I'd been on a 3-week tear. And I was stone cold sober, and the truth was I woke up with one clear thought in my mind that I had no more answers. I knew where I had to go, which was here. I'd been trying, but I hadn't been honest. And I came back here, and I went to a meeting that night. And that was a meeting that was around the corner from my house. And I'd never been to that meeting in nearly the 12 years I've been coming. I was a cameo appearance guy. I picked a meeting on the other side of town. You know, I'd show up on an occasion. And I went to this meeting, and there was a guy that moved back to town that night, and he went to that meeting too. And his name's Paul. He's my sponsor today. And, you know, he was there that night, and I was there that night. And we've never been back to that meeting since. Not once. Not because we just didn't want to go. It's just never worked out that way. But that night, we were both in the same room at the same time. And I remember he walked over to me and said, Barry, he knew me. I'd met him at a wedding a few years before. I was the best man for a buddy of mine in here. And he said, Barry, here's my number. I want you to call me. I know you're going to drink because it's in your eyes. And, you know, I swear to God, that was the first time in all those years in AA that I heard somebody say they cared. Now, lots of people had told me they cared. I just couldn't hear them. And I had lots of phone numbers to go golfing and go on holidays. That's what I was interested in. But staying sober, this was the only time that I was interested in staying sober. And, you know, they say when the pupil's willing, the teacher appears, and that's what happened to me. And I was overwhelmed by that, and I called him the next day. We went to a meeting, and, you know, I asked him if he'd be my sponsor, and he said, come on over Tuesday night and bring your big book. And I went over, and he said, Barry, I phoned around and asked about you, and everybody's wished me luck. And I thought that was very unkind, too, but I didn't say anything. He said, but we'll try. And here's the deal. It's a very simple one, and it doesn't get any greater than this. He said, I want you to call me every day, and I want you to tell me what you're doing. Please, we're not going to discuss how you feel and what you think, because I don't care. He said, we're going to try to change that eventually, over a period of time. And he said, I just want to know what you're doing, and I want to tell you that you're going to... And he tricked me. He said, you pray, of course, don't you? When you get asked the question that way, you have to say yes. You don't want to look too stupid. So I said yes. And he said, you're going to have to work these steps. But you don't have to work them alone. I'll do it all with you. Because this is what I do in my life. And he said, there's only one problem with that, Barry. He said, if you stop working these steps, I can't make you start again. And if you stop, we're not going to have a lot to talk about. And one of us is going to get drunk, and it will not be me. And that got my attention, because I actually wanted to stay sober. So I actually began this journey that started 15 years ago, and it has turned into a remarkable life. You know, I believe anyways that when you invite God into your life, coupled with the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, that you unleash a power within you that will propel you in a manner that you have never known, that you could never comprehend. And my life has changed immensely. Has it been a walk in the park? I don't think so. Everything I've ever experienced of great difficulty has been during sobriety. I've had days where, my God, I used to think, geez, I got sober for this. You know, and I know lots of people in AA that, you know, have difficult times. And they're really hard. There's no quick antidote. You know, there's some days that the wheels just fall off the wagon. You know, difficulties happen in your life. Okay, death and all, you know, divorce and bankruptcy. They all happen to me. Maybe I'm different. And you know, all these things happen, and they're going to happen on an ongoing basis. And I used to say to myself when they would happen, Jesus, Barry, you're working a lousy program. You know, and somebody would tell me, geez, you better inventory that. And I would think, oh, and they'd give me these quick one-liners. It wasn't my sponsor. But they, you know, give me these quick one-liners like, stop thinking. Or you got to change how you feel. Change how I feel. I tried doing that for 30 years with a bottle. I was never successful at changing how I feel. I've been praying like hell since I got here, and I've never been able to change how I feel. The one thing that I have to learn to do is accept how I feel. That this is what's going on in my life. And based on the facts and the circumstances that are taking part in my life, I probably should feel this way. So, you see, if I accept how I feel and say that this is the truth of my life, I can plot a course to move on from there. And then I have to take some action. And I learned when I first got sober 15 years ago that an expression of my gratitude would not be what I say. The gratitude truly was an action. It had my sponsor drilled that into my head. And he said, you know what, if you're grateful, you'll be at your group every Monday and Thursday night. You'll be on the door. You'll make the coffee. You'll set up the room. You'll sponsor guys. You know, it's all about what you do, not what you say. And nothing is more important than me being at my home group, not being here, up here. I mean, it's important that you're here. You're the success of the conference, not the few of us that ended up getting up here. It's all about you. I actually am privileged today to feel in my heart that I'm associated with some of the finest people in the world. That's you. So it's been a long journey and a lot of fun, you know, and I guess I'm getting close. Jeez, it goes quick. You know, there's so many things that you could say up here. I'm going to tell you one quick story, and I'm going to sit down and shut up. I never knew how to live when I got here. The 11-step prayer I thought was an impossibility if I looked at all those qualities. And I remember being in a step study when I was 6 months sober. And I remember being asked to go home because they gave me homework. And to write down all the qualities that I perceived God would have to be my God. And I remember going home and writing down these qualities of love, kindness, forgiveness, understanding, all patient and all powerful and never abandoned me. And I remember sitting in the den with my son, who was 4 at the time. He's 19 now. And I remember sitting there, and I was reading this back to myself before I went to my meeting that night. And, you know, it's been my experience that I believe, anyways, God talks to all of us. I'm usually so wrapped up in myself, I'm unavailable for the call. But I'm working on that. So the truth is, I'm sitting there, and the book says that God does. When faced with difficulty, if I pause and ask for, you know, for direction, intuitive thought will come. Where'd that come from? Not me. I'm sitting there, and I hear this small voice in the back of my head say, okay, Barry, I am all those things. And in turn, I want you to go and practice those things in your life. And I looked at my 4-year-old son, and I knew that this was the things that were missing in my life, that I had never acted in a responsible manner. I had never showed care, concern, love. And that 4-year-old boy takes for granted that I have all those qualities. And I knew that that would be my job from that day to this, was to try to become a better human being. And you've all helped me do that. Enjoy the rest of the conference. God bless.
I'm not going to tell my story, so you don't have to go yet. I am going to say that last night at the flag ceremony, we're sitting in level 200 and section 232, and I know the people on this side of me, and I met the people behind me, and this couple from Canada come and sit down, and when they start the flags, the guy starts naming the flags before the announcer says them, and I start thinking, oh my God, I've been talking to him, and now I feel stupid because this guy is brilliant. I mean, he is saying countries of names I don't even know how to pronounce. And I'm thinking, all he does is he looks at the flag and he's like spitting out names. And I'm thinking, he is smart. He might be the smartest guy I have ever met. And then I go, wow. He goes, they're written right across there. So if you were looking across the stadium, you got a little advance notice of who was coming. Because I was thinking, actually, I sat down next to him and I said, my husband apologizes for you having to sit next to me. In advance. He feels sorry for you. Okay. I want to thank all the speakers. I think they did a great job. And it says that I get to close the meeting however I like, and in Florida we close with the Lord's Prayer. So that's what we'll do. Have we got a chance? Okay. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not to temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Keep coming back. Thank you.